This is Ladson Hinton, 14 March 1997. Individuation, Narcissism, and the Hunt for the Wild Unicorn.
I appreciate very much being invited, as I always do, to come to the Jung Society to present. And I think often we, all the trouble you all go to hold these events and all the footwork and thought and everything, I'd certainly like to thank you for the public service as well as my own opportunity to be here. I think that's often overlooked, having been on the other side of arranging things. I've been interested in such a crazy thing as unicorns vaguely in the back of my psyche since we lived in Europe in the middle 60s, and we were going to Paris for a weekend, and a German student, a friend, she said, go by the Musée de Cluny. There's something there you'd really like. And so being in Paris in April, a romantic weekend, and we went and we saw these tapestries and this beautiful museum that's a large medieval structure. It was quite a moving experience, but I just appreciated the poetic beauty. I didn't do much with it, but it sort of filtered in slowly over the years, and I think at first I was rather romantic about the unicorn and thought, what a quaint creature. And then as I got sort of acquainted with my own various wild unicorn energies and this or that, I thought perhaps it's a bit more of a troublesome, difficult creature. And for some reason, the last year or two, it's just sort of been sinking more into my psyche in a way that I felt I wanted to kind of follow it up. It's just like it's been sitting there for 30 years now. And I think I like it because it captures some very basic things about life. It's also, for me, my original interest in Jungian psychology was due to the symbolic and religious aspect. And although I've gone off into clinical a great deal and have spoken in those areas, this is kind of a return for me to my basic interest in Jung, which is has to do with symbolism and religion, although I'll try to add a few little clinical elements in here also to sort of mix it up. I have a lot of slides, and the last part of the lecture, or the bulk of it, I'll present with slides, but it's not time to start them yet. So, not yet. Now, I'll give you a minute. Give everyone a chance to sit down. Can you hear all right, or any problem? Here? You hear? Oh, the radiator. A little louder? Oh, okay. Got it? Yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah, 1, 2, 3. That's the mystical hunt for the unicorn is the story of the relationship of the ordinary and the extraordinary, the everyday and the transcendent, the endless fascination and desire of each realm for the other. It passionately describes the process of the mysterium conjunctionis, the endless play of opposites, as Jung said, confronting one another in enmity or attracting one another in love. It's a story of restless life, of ever-changing life, life constantly ending and being reborn out of the infant reservoir of being. We call this reservoir the self, the pleroma, God, psychic energy, kundalini, and many other names. The everyday longs for and depends upon infusions from the divine to give it meaning, purpose, and aliveness. On the other hand, the divine seems to depend upon the everyday for its actualization, for its completion. As in the movie Wings of Desire, that some of you may have seen, the color and passion of incarnate life fulfills the abstract angelic realm. I think that's what I like so much about these unicorn images. I think in psychology, these images are very emotional, provocative, and earthy. Kazantzakis wrote about human existence itself as the savior of God. He wrote a little book called The Saviors of God. The ideal is beautiful but pallid. The real is sweaty and turbulent, but vital and passionate. Desire is what draws these realms together, desire. Desire in the endless drama of their interplay and longing, each for completion in the other. The Unicorn Hunt richly depicts that never-ending drama. We tend to think of the unicorn as a sort of a sweet and sentimental creature. However, in the legends of the world, it had a complex and often quite demonic nature. It was often noted, too, for its raucous bray. No one has discovered a real unicorn, and it's only a creature of the human imagination, but certainly quite powerful nevertheless. The narwhal, a sort of small whale, has a single tusk, and these were sold as unicorn horns in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. They could fetch a high price since they were believed to protect against poison. The custom of using a hollowed unicorn horn as a magically protected drinking vessel came originally from India. In China, the unicorn was known as the Qi Lin, the male-female, and it was believed to live up to 1,000 years. It emitted beams of the five sacred colors, and its body was seen as yin and the horn as yang. Like the stork, it was associated with announcing births and was said to have announced the birth and death of Confucius, Confucius. Temple iconography shows it bowing to the Buddha to hear his original sermon. Its horn was seen as representing nirvana. Jung wrote of the unicorn in Psychology and Alchemy and equated it with the spirit Mercurius, but some alchemical writings, in fact, Lambspring comes to mind, do use the unicorn to symbolize spirit per se. I feel, however, that to think of it just as spirit is reductionistic. I mentioned, too, there's very little written in the Jungian literature. In fact, I haven't found anything except one article by Jung, amazingly enough, as moving and rich as these tapestries are. If anyone knows of any Jungian thing, there are lots of others, please let me know. The unicorn was disseminated into Western lore through the Septuagint Bible of the 3rd century B.C. and was carried forward into the Latin Vulgate Bible of St. Jerome, who began his work around 386 A.D. And from this version, it was included in the Palm Sunday Mass. Later biblical scholars have asserted that unicorn was a mistranslation of the word for wild ox or a roque. Whatever the facts, it's clear unicorn was a living being in the psyche of our ancestors. The Physiologus was a work on natural philosophy, probably written in Alexandria around 200 AD. It's a collection of stories about the peculiarities of natural objects. It was translated into many languages and was second in popularity only to the Bible during the Middle Ages. There was a clear Indian influence and probably a Gnostic one. The unicorn was described as being extremely strong and spirited and could only be constrained by a virgin. No one else could trap it or kill it or anything. The Physiologus follows Indian tales where there was often a strongly erotic emphasis. There was a lot of Indian traders came through Alexandria, and so there was a kind of a cultural synthesis of Greek and Middle Eastern and Indian thought in that time. To quote R.R. Beer, who has a very nice book on the unicorn, he's quoting the Physiologus. He says, when the unicorn enters the virgin's bosom, it takes the place of the child, which she will eventually bear, that is, the divine child. Its horn is a definite symbol of its virility. The damsel lures the unicorn through her scent, shows him her knee and breast, actually taking him as a lover or pet, and offers him her milk, which so drugs the animal that it drops asleep in her lap. Of course, then it's helpless. In other versions, if the unicorn found that the woman was not a true virgin, it transfixed her with its horn. So it was quite a difficult character. But I could show the first slides, please, now. Let's see. I've got one of these little pointers. I've used slides in every lecture I've ever given since. I have so much fun pointing it around. But here's a unicorn, wild-looking character. Here's a man in a well, four serpents spitting poison. black and a white mouse gnawing at the limb he clings to as he reaches for a bit of honey dropping from the limb. Here's a dragon down here. The story behind this, it comes from India, is that this man was pursued by a wild unicorn representing death or fate or something, and he falls in this well, and as he falls, he grasps this branch, and then as he's there in this precarious state, the honey drips down, and in that moment, he's infatuated with the honey. Hindu scholars take this as the infinite capacity for human beings to become deluded and live in a state of illusion, no matter that this is our transient life, indeed, this is the state we're in, and we don't even notice it most of the time. I tend to think of it as a person trying to escape fate. The unicorn sort of represents a wild energy, and if you try to escape your fate, you do get in very difficult pickles, but maybe you find yourself. But anyway, I see the serpents. This is called the Golden Legend. There are the mice. There's the unicorn. There's the dragon. This is just from a bestiary from the early 1500s, typical front cover discussing the unicorn. Here's a sweet little unicorn, almost childlike. This is from the 14th century, I think. This is supposed an etching from a legend of a Hindu Indian hunt for the unicorn. You see, it's really... no one can ever kill it unless the virgin subdued it first, except with some exceptions we'll talk about. Over here are some lovers. But anyway, it's quite a wild scene. This is a wild woman and the unicorn, and wild creatures of the forest. Men and women had a special affinity for the unicorn, and there was overlap, and they were the only ones who really sometimes were said to could tame it or kill it, but they were usually on friendly terms. But there's a lot of association of wild women, and maybe women who run with wolves can get along with the unicorn. I don't know about that. Here's a nice, peaceful unicorn, almost like a child. Here's a Durer engraving, kind of a wild, demonic unicorn for sure. Here's Adam and Eve, the unicorn associated with Eve. There's the old serpent. Here's Adam with the lion. Lion and unicorn are sometimes paired, as lion is often the sun and the unicorn the moon. Here's a more peaceful wild woman with the unicorn. I can't quite find its head in there. There's the horn, I guess. It's a... Oh, there it is. There. Oh, there's the horn. Yeah. It's kind of... I like this one. Here's the wild man after the unicorn. And I'll show a close-up of that. Here's he sneaking in from the corner. The slide didn't take too well, but there's the poor little unicorn. Small in this case. And this is quite a beautiful picture, I think. It's from a cushion, woven cushion from the 15th century. So that's all for that series right now. We'll get on to the tapestries after I give you a little bit of background about the unicorn tapestries and such themselves. So I hope you can get a sense, though, of the varied nature of the unicorn. I mean, it's childlike, it's totally demonic and wild, it's tameable, it's frightening and untamable. The most famous unicorn tapestries are French from around 1500 and were probably made in Belgium. Tapestries such as these were designed only after extended dialogue between patron and manufacturer as to themes. I mean, these weren't just artistic inspiration. They were carefully planned. They are made from cartoons or detailed drawings. Of course, they're quite expensive. Those in the Musée de Cluny in Paris deal with the five senses and were likely manufactured for Anne of Brittany. George Sand was instrumental, as a matter of fact, in their recovery when they were lost. The hunting series, which I will show you, is from the same period of time, that is around 1500, probably made for a wedding, but the original owners are unknown. Both sets of tapestries, interestingly, were seized by the peasants during the Revolution. and were only recovered decades later, being used as coverings for haystacks and manure. Quite astounding that they survived as well as they have. John D. Rockefeller bought the hunting series from the Rochefoucauld family, who had owned them from the 17th century. He loved them greatly, and it's quite moving to hear descriptions of that. He built a special room that was like a meditation room, and it was completely surrounded by these tapestries. And it was quite a special place, evidently. And then he donated them later to the Cloisters Museum in New York, which is a medieval convent made into, you know, for exhibitions and as a museum. The last part of the 15th century, the period of these tapestries, the late Middle Ages, was a special time in history, and I think that mentioned a few things about historical background. The Hundred Years' War, which was an awful war, had ended. France had been decimated, but was recovering, and there was relative peace and stability in the region, first in a long time, and France was becoming, of course, unified at that time. The printing press had drastically reduced the cost of books during the middle of the 15th century. Cities and capitalism were growing in power, but the mindset was still Gothic in Northern Europe. During the bulk of the Middle Ages, pagan themes usually were somewhat, at least semi-disguised in Christian, under Christian, with Christian themes. But during the 15th century, the pagan themes and the old themes became much more flagrantly, blatantly into the open as Christianity, the hold of the church, weakened. The tapestries help us return, in my mind, to a time when human beings still believed themselves, though, to be living in a divine world. It was a very intense and passionate period of human history, and people tended to respond very emotionally to life events. If anyone is as nutty as I am and is interested in history of culture, there's a new edition of a book called The Autumn of the Middle Ages by Huizinga, which is a classic. It's not dry history, but really how people experienced things and felt. And the mythic influences specifically on the tapestries came from several directions. First, there's a connection with Christianity and the birth and passion of Christ. This was heavily imbued with the cult of the Virgin, which so dominated the Middle Ages. A flood of books had amplified the interest in the Greek and Roman deities, who were known as forces of nature. There was an encyclopedic interest in the symbolism of animal and plant life, and people would have books of symbolism about all these things. And a love of story and fantasy and an intoxication with classical myth was part of the time and consumed artists and patrons as well as the common people of the day. Underpinning all this was an upsurge of the ancient Indo-European religions with their cosmologies and deities and their cyclic calendar of seasons, which we will talk about a great deal. Through studying these tapestries, we can gain insight into a time, as I said, when myth was not so fragmented. People experienced life and nature as an allegory of meaning. As an alchemy, we can more deeply comprehend the cyclic transformation of energies and hopefully thereby understand better the general relation of ego and self and the evolution of psychic energy in general, and the process of individuation and transformation. For the people of late medieval times, animals and plants symbolized saints and sinners, gods and goddesses. They have very precise meaning. As I say, these weren't just artistic inspirations. They had definite ideas about these things. The availability of the written word enriched the pre-existing oral tradition. As I said, the printing press had been going around for a few decades then. The universe was a vast cryptogram just to be decoded. In this spirit, we must try to understand the meaning of the tapestries that we'll talk about. Why is the unicorn hunted at all? Why is it pursued to death? Why does a virgin entrap it? I owe much of my interpretation of these tapestries to John Williamson's excellent book, The Oak King, the Holly King, and the Unicorn, published in 1986. The oak and the holly occupy a central place in most of the iconography. This suggests a connection between ancient seasonal rituals and the hunt, capture, and death of the unicorn. The oak was revered as a central tree in the forest by the early Indo-Europeans. By the Middle Ages, it had become the tree of kings and was seen in cathedrals, on benches, in stained glass, and in the margins of Bibles and books of hours. In The Golden Bough, the great classic of myth, Fraser posits the sacred grove was oak. And the bough itself, after which the book was named, was the evergreen golden mistletoe which grew upon its branches. The oak was an icon of strength and the sacred emblem of Zeus, Jupiter, and Thor. It came to represent the time of the year when days began to lengthen and brighten after the dark barrenness of winter. It was connected with the defeat of winter and the time when the gods released their fertilizing rains. It's important to note that the oak blossoms around just around the June solstice. While the oak varies in its vegetative display, holly is evergreen. It does not go barren in winter, and this must have been particularly reassuring to those people living in this time in northern climes. There is a variety of holly whose leaves are oak-like, from which its mythology may derive. Holly was popular in the Roman Saturnalia, and houses were decked with it from very early times to give protection against storms and to bring fertility. You know, I'm sure you know the Christmas carol, deck the halls with boughs of holly. It's a very old idea. In pre-Christian times, the earth mother of agrarian societies was often represented by a triple goddess representing bride, mother, and crone. Spring, summer, and winter are love, birth, and death. The oak tree and the holly tree were regarded as two divine kings, one representing the waxing and the other the waning season or cycles of the sun. These divine kings were the consorts of the priestess, often representing the triple goddess, and were alternately sacrificed on midsummer and midwinter days. In symbolic imagery, this legacy persisted into medieval times. To an agricultural people, the well-being of Mother Nature, of course, was of critical importance. They didn't have frozen foods and so forth. Their very lives depended upon the harvest and upon the fluctuations of cold and heat and snow and rain. They tried to keep their kings healthy, but the seasons had their frighteningly inevitable cycles. It was crucial that the man-god be killed before he was enfeebled so that his powers could be transferred to a vigorous successor. Through an unending line of transmissions, the fertility of the land and people could be maintained. The wasteland could be avoided. The wasteland motif in T.S. Eliot comes from imagery from, of course, the Parsifal myth, but also generally the vegetation cycle myths. Fertility festivals took place in Europe in spring and summer. They were homeopathic, that is, imitative rituals performed by mummers, actors, and mimes, and intended to make the grass green, the barley and wheat germinate, and the flowers bloom. The more closely the mock marriage of the leaf-clad or flower-clad mummers aped the real marriage of the woodland sprites, the more effective would be the charm. So these tended to be kind of erotic festivals. In legend, the Holly King became the Green Knight and the Green Man, or Wild Man, of legend. For instance, you may be familiar with Gawain and the Green Knight, though the Green Knight is a green man. You know, he doesn't die. He can chop his head off. He doesn't die. Whereas Gawain is connected with the sun, and he has a cyclic sort of existence. The Green Man represents, among other things, the power of nature to persist. And the Wild Man may be connected with its fearsome and unpredictable aspects, its quirks and calamities. The Green Men and Wild Men were frequently depicted in the iconography of the times, and the unicorn was often related to this mythic perspective. The unicorn persists, like the Wild Men and the Green Men, through all the changes of the seasons. Similar to the Wild Man, the unicorn, too, was captured, killed, and then resurrected. The evils of old age and barrenness died with it. Like the vital fruitfulness of nature, the unicorn dies, but is always there as a possibility. Christ, like the wild man, became the scapegoat for the possible ill fortune that endangered and frightened the people. It is easy to see how the stories of Christ and the unicorn overlapped and were synthesized. The unicorn tapestries, therefore, depict an unfolding drama of the seasons. It is repeated annually, strongly contrasting with our very linear view of time. The people, plants, and animals fit into carefully selected mythology. This mythology can enrich our knowledge of the psyche. Individuals, relationships, and whole societies undergo inevitable cycles of death and rebirth. Our attitudes toward these cycles are indeed an index to our character, how we accept them, how we relate to them, our integrity. By translating these remarkable works of art, we can gain, I hope, important insights into the nature of individuation and with its cyclic vicissitudes. So now I'm going to show you the tapestries in order. We'll go through the first four and then take a break, and I'll do the last three. And I'm going to just leave them up so you can look at them while we talk. Let's see. Here we are, the start of the hunt. Can you see that all right? You can see in this, there's a ripe cherry tree, which is a central figure. There's a fellow over here just beckoning, you know, in the woods. Here's an ash tree, which was very important in the mythology. And here's some palms down here, some small palm trees. And, of course, loyal hounds and hunters. And this fellow seems to be the in charge of the hunt. But the theme of this scene is spring, rebirth, and cosmic renewal. Several trees are prominent, and each is symbolic. Of course, this is just the beginning of the hunt. They're just getting ready. In the center is a cherry tree laden with fruit. The cherry was frequently associated with the birth of Christ. It's the first tree to flower and bear fruit in the spring. A blossoming cherry is a common motif in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean painting, symbolizing the renewing power of nature as it bursts forth from the bonds of winter. It was believed to be a brave tree, manifesting courage by its early blossoming and braving the last of the snow. Off to the right by the AE, as I showed you, is a prominent ash tree. AE are obviously initials having to do with whoever originally commissioned the tapestries, but no one knows who that is. The ash tree is over there on the right. The ash tree was a very prominent tree, of course, in mythology. It was sacred to Poseidon and Woden and was connected with fire, lightning, and rain. In both Roman and Norse mythology, the ash appears as the ancestor of the human race. In the prose Edda, Yggdrasil, the sacred ash, was the great ash sacred to Woden, the tree of life, that is. Its roots reach down to the kingdoms beneath the earth, and its branches engulf the universe. The first man came from the ash, and there were other connections with divine infancy. The palm appears as small shrubs at the base of the ash tree. It was venerated as an immortal tree since it never loses its leaves. It gets new branches every month. It bears fruit until it dies and so is often identified with the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. The palm was also identified with the phoenix. It's from these ancient connections that the palm became, of course, important in Christianity, such as the Palm Sunday and so forth. The noble with the white plume hat is directing the activities. Up in the corner is the scout, who seems on the track of the quarry. The hunter is the man who knows the ways of nature. He is usually a positive figure in myths and fairy tales. Take Red Riding Hood, for example. The hunter saves her. There were times when the human world was surrounded, of course, by woods. The towns and woods merged into one another, and nature was a constant wild presence, and those who truly knew her were greatly admired. The hounds are highly interesting. They're generally associated with the virtues, such as beauty, kindness, intelligence, largesse, gentleness, and sincerity. They had various names like that. Of course, they are also connected to goddesses such as Diana. Dogs are the companions of the human race and may be best seen here as representing the domesticated instincts. To summarize the iconography, the overriding motif seems to be the awakening of Earth in early spring and the cosmic preparation of the Earth for a time of growth and abundance. These images portray the beginning of the waxing cycle, that is, the emergence of nature, the time when Hercules in mythology had strangled the serpents of the old year. The powerful ash and other plants helped to drive away the reptiles, which were seen as representing the pollutions of evil in winter. Psychologically speaking, this would be a time of early awakening from a plateau of life or the beginning of emergence from lassitude or depression, a kind of beginning awakening. The ego, in the form of the hunters, is becoming aware of the potential new life in the woods, the creative unconscious. Hence, the vitality emanate from the psyche, as from the ash or from the world tree. The promise of the self beckons, and desire for renewed life arouses the heart with a sense of movement and exciting possibility. A new waxing cycle is beginning. This is the unicorn at the fountain. The unicorn dips its horn in the stream to rid it of poison. I'll point out a few things here in the beginning. We have to get some bifocals here. Here's the fountain, of course, at the center. And here's a pomegranate spouting water. That's a pomegranate. Lion's head's a partridge, which I will show you more about, representing Narcissus in pretty invariably in mythology in this period. Just peering at its image, here's some goldfinches, which are often symbols of the soul, and Christ often seen holding finches. Here's lions, a leopard, a genet, which is sort of a weasel-like animal, a very mean-looking wolf, a stag, and... So in the center, there's an oak tree. This is an oak tree, which is beginning to be prominent. And right over here is some holly. So I'd like to show you. This is just a blow-up of the pheasant. See the wonderful detail in these tapestries still. This is a picture of Narcissus from Narcissus Tapestry at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. See, very similar. There's the lion's head's fountain gazing in. Here's a pheasant. I don't know all these animals, but they...